So I think that's about it for the housekeeping. So for those who would care to join us, let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. You could raise your virtual hand or wave at the window or something just to let us know. Anybody? All right, I'm going to assume there's people in here in their first 30 days anyway. How do you like that? So, let's see, I've asked Phil to read the AA preamble. Of course, I will need to unmute you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Phil, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Phil.
AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endures nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help alcoholics.
Other alcoholics?
Yeah, I don't see the rest of it. It's, you have to scroll up. There you go. Help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Okay.
Oh. Neither endorses nor opposes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
All right, brother. Thank you. All right, we're running like a well-oiled machine here tonight. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask-it basket. Tonight, we're very excited to welcome Steve L. from Nashville, Tennessee, to tell his story. After he tells the story, we'll at the top of the hour, we'll give him a little break, and we'll do the seventh tradition, maybe take a couple of announcements, etc. But we'll have the opportunity to send questions to, you'll see, if you open your participants tab, you'll see a user called questions, and you'll be able to chat your questions to the user questions, and then we'll reconvene the meeting and ask those questions. So without further ado, I give you Steve. Steve?
Thank you, David, and good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic.
Steve. And,
I am grateful to be invited into the Simple Actions Group tonight. So thank you, David, for having me. I looked around, already see I got a few friends in attendance, and Bob and Debbie, I see you guys over there. It just looks like a judgment row to me. Somebody, you look here and see these squares, and you wonder, I'll be reading your faces. The other thing I have to tell you that I've looked at the number of participants. There are 42 of us here. If we end at 37 or 38, it'll break my heart that I ran those five people off. So I'm so insecure. I beg you to stay. The other thing I'd say is that it's I go to a lot of Zoom meetings, as I bet some of you guys do. And trust me, many of the times I'm the person with my video off. But I will tell you, I love it when you've got your video on. Now, granted, we've all seen things we should never see on these Zoom meetings, and I know that's true. But I always think when I look up and see the video off, it's like somebody's in the regular meeting but turned their back to me, you know, turned their chair around so I can't see them. So I'm not offended, but I invite you to join us with video. I tell you, this has been an interesting time, right? I know we hear that at almost every meeting when we start, but it's so for me to be able to come visit with you guys virtually this evening is a really cool deal. And I am really missing the face-to-face meetings, and I don't see this in any way as a long-term replacement. But I absolutely know that that this is going to be a companion piece to what we've done. And I think that used well, this can be such a valuable additional component to our recovery. I've been to Iran. I've been to Canada. I've attended meetings in Australia. I've been all over the world in these 3 months that we've been sitting at home. And tonight I'm with you guys. I tell you, my sobriety date is June the 30th, 1989. And my home group is the Recovery on the Road group of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets every Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. And when we're meeting in person, we meet right on Historic Music Row here in Nashville, just a few blocks from my home. But we also have converted our group to Zoom. And I'll tell you, I love it. I know this is a small enough crowd that most of you guys know each other. And I've been to a lot of the big Zoom events, and they're cool, and I enjoy it. But I really love being invited into somebody's home group. And I love the fact that the vast majority of you folks probably know each other. And that's the feeling I get on Wednesday nights when I'm with my home group. And we have about 20 to 25 people. Typically, it's a small group, yet it feels personal to me. I know we'll sit here, and one of the things I realized after talking on Zoom a few different times is the very first event that I spoke on, there were 1,000 people in attendance. And I was watching that number of participants click up from 600 to 800 to 900, and I saw myself, felt myself speaking more loudly as more people came on so the people in the back could hear me. I realize we're all on the virtual front row here. So really what we're having is a conversation. In some ways, it's intimate in that way that everybody's on the front row. And so that's kind of the way I'm going to approach it tonight, is just have a conversation. I'm a little disappointed. I think David mentioned I'm actually in my office at work. And I had to work up until I ran away from where I was into this office 10 minutes ago to get to the meeting. But at home, I've invested fully. I'm all in on the Zoom, and I've invested on the green screen. And man, I got all the cool backgrounds, and you would be so impressed if you could see that waterfall behind me and that stuff. But unfortunately, I'm just here with bad lighting that makes my head shine, and you guys will just have to deal with it. I told you that sobriety date's June 30th, 89. I did not, June the 29th is the last time I've had a drink or a drug. And I will tell you, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a hardcore alcoholic. I got a special relationship with alcohol. I got the relationship with alcohol that the big book talks about, that I've got that allergy to alcohol that is the single symptom that sets us apart as a distinct entity. And I've got that mental obsession that gives me that strange mental blank spot around alcohol when I'm in an unrecovered state. But as deep and committed as my relationship is to alcohol, I have to tell you that it was not a monogamous relationship. We invited other people to the party. So while I was regularly, alcohol was my steady date, but we sometimes had threesomes and foursomes, you know? So there was a lot going on in my life before I got sober. On that June the 29th of 1989, however, I gave no thought to getting sober. I had no intention of going from that night until this between drinks. And I can prove that by sharing with you that the last drink of alcohol I've had was an amaretto on the rocks. And if you were getting ready to have your last drink, I bet it would not be amaretto. And I promise you, that's not the way I would have gone down if I'd had a little advance notice. But the truth is, I was scheduled into a treatment facility on July the 1st of 1989. And I use that word scheduled because that's absolutely the case. I was not going because I wanted and needed to get sober in my mind. I wasn't going to have some revolutionary change in my attitude and outlook. I wasn't going to have a vital spiritual experience. I was going simply to fulfill my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee, for the conviction of my sixth DUI a year before. And as a result of that plea bargain that I cut that day, they gave me some jail time, but they cut off some of that jail time if I would go to residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation. Now, that's a mouthful. I had never heard all those words strung together in one sentence, but there it was, and it sounded slightly better than jail. So I said, I agreed to that. And I'm here to report it was slightly better than jail. But the truth is, I had a wonderful treatment experience. I didn't know what to expect, so my wife and I went out on June the 29th with three other couples. It was a pretty tame evening. This was not some terrible crash and burn bottom. That had happened months before. But this was just a last hurrah before I was going away. And then we spent a day with my daughter, Abby. And then on Saturday morning, July the 1st, my friend Ricky came by to pick me up to drive me off to treat and just to go do my time. And my wife, Connie, Bob and Deb know my wife, Connie. She walked me out to the car. And I got the kind of support from Connie I know a lot of my brothers and sisters in AA didn't get. Her last words to me before pulling out were, "No matter what, baby, don't stop drinking." At Connie's rock solid. But we go, and you, I will share with you that she wasn't trying to get me to stop drinking. She was trying to get me to drink with her. She was trying to get me to not do some of the things I was doing. She was trying to get me to be a better husband. She was trying to get me to be a better father. But she wasn't trying to get me to stop drinking because we met over a drink. We had met, we were married 7 years at the time, and we had met just about 8 years before this. And Connie had just come back to Nashville after living in Lake Tahoe, where she was a baccarat dealer in Harrah's Casino. She had gotten divorced from her husband out there, and she rolled into Nashville with a divorce pickup truck and a divorce pocket full of money and a divorce eight ball of cocaine, and I fell immediately head over heels for her. And we went out, a friend of mine and I went to a bar, a little place called Cheers, and walked in, and another friend of ours was there with Connie and introduced us, and we hooked up right there. A few months later, we went on a trip to Mexico and drank something out of a coconut, and ended up on a boat that took us out to what they swear were international waters. And an Austrian merchant marine read what he swears was a wedding ceremony, but he read it in Spanish. Now, Connie and I don't speak Spanish, so we're not sure what we agreed to on that boat, but 37 years later, we're still arguing about that. But we came back, and we were married, apparently. And our life started. But that morning, she's walking me out and says, "No matter what, don't stop drinking." She says, I don't drink the Kool-Aid over there. I don't know what you're going to be selling. You go do your time and come back, and it's back on. Now, other people in my life weren't trying to get me to quit drinking. I come from a drinking family. Obviously, I spent most of my time with drinking friends. I did have people. People did grab Connie when we started dating. They had an intervention on her. And they asked her, they begged her, in fact, not to get in a car with me. They said, "I know y'all are going to go out, but just meet him places. Don't get in the car with him." because I had totaled six automobiles. And I've gotten these multiple DUIs, a couple after we were married. And I'm a drunk that just had to get in the car and go somewhere. And I'm not a, yet toward the end, I will say, toward the end, I'm a guy that had to come in and lock the door and close the blinds. So these things change over time. But at any rate, my friend Ricky was driving me over to this treatment facility that was just about 5 miles from my house. And I walked in there and they gave me, I always refer to it as a test. I know now that the clinical term is I was getting an assessment, which is also not any friendlier a term. I was being assessed. People are going to draw conclusions about me based on how I answer these questions. And the questions made no sense at all. You cannot, there's nobody can pass that. You know, they had questions. You guys know because you've heard them. You've taken some version of this. But in addition to the psychosocial workup that we did, and I will tell you, I have my treatment to file, and I've read my psychosocial workup. I wouldn't even let my sponsor see that. I'm telling you. Now, that's some hideous stuff. But the assessment they gave me to assess my relationship to alcohol, and they had a lot of alcohol-based questions, and each one of the questions began with the phrase, have you ever? Have you ever? Which they said means even once, and even with a really good reason. Have you ever drank in the morning? Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever had trouble at work because of drinking? Have you ever had trouble at home because of drinking? 30 questions. Have you ever questions, which you know, just have check yes or check no to what I forever will contend are essay questions. These are questions that beg for an explanation. You can't just, I had questions about the questions. I mean, We kind of laugh on here, but I know when I look back, because that day, trust me, I couldn't make myself check the box, right? Because I know they're going to draw conclusions about me. And how can you do that without the background information? How can you do that without context for this answer? Now, I know today just how easy it is to do that. But in that moment, as much as it seems absurd today, I promise you, I was angst-ridden about checking this box. Have you ever drank in the morning? I said, what do you mean by morning? Because I think that this is a legitimate question, because one of my problems is I think I know what they're asking me, right? See, and I've done that all my life, is I misinterpret, I take information that's incorrect, and I make life-changing decisions based on this bad information. But when they ask me if I drink in the morning, I think they're asking me if I'm that guy that's got a half pint of hot vodka on the nightstand and has to take a pull off of it at 4 a.m. just to fight off the sweats and the shakes, just to be able to ease into his day. And I've done that a couple of times, but not so often I'm checking it on this test. And have you ever drank alone? Oh, yeah, but they left, you know. Would you ever just tell you, it was a party just a minute ago. Where'd everybody go? And again, I think I know what they're asking me, right? I think they're asking me if I'm that guy that's got to go home and close the door and lock it and pull the shades and dim the lights and drink in isolation, hiding from the world. And man, you can bet I did that a few times, but I'm not going to admit to it on this test. But there's another kind of alone drinking that I did. And I'm a guy that had to drink to go drinking, right? I got a drink to go drinking. But I would contend, even years later, is drinking to go drinking really drinking? I think drinking to go drinking sort of like stretching to go exercise. I think it's a preparatory work. It's not actual drinking, is it? They seem to think it was. And the reason that I had to drink to go drinking is in our book refers to it it says that for many of us, alcohol served as a social lubricant. And man, I get that, right? It feels like I'm oiling myself up so I can move easily amongst you. And without that lubrication, I feel like the ball in the pinball machine that's just bumping into everything, just ill at ease. And the truth is, that's how I felt, but that's not how I looked. Because I know what it's like to get ready to go through a door and walk into a work situation or a family situation or a social situation, even with friends, and be sober and need to steel myself up to go through that door and then act like I've got it together, to try to act like a guy would act if he were comfortable, if he were confident, if he were outgoing, if he were personable, if he were gregarious. Act like I would act like whatever I think is going to impress you or get from you what I think I need. Because what I'm confident will not work is me showing up as me. And I don't understand that I've got this selfishness and self-centeredness that's the root of my problem. I don't understand how in the world could I have alcoholism when I'm not drinking. I didn't understand until I really didn't get it till I'd been sober a little while that I've got alcoholism even when I'm not drinking. And, you know, there's a great passage in our book, In a Vision for You, talking about Dr. Bob. And it says, he knew he was somehow painfully abnormal, but he did not yet fully understand what it meant to be alcoholic. I can't tell you how much time I felt painfully aware that I was somehow abnormal. Now, I didn't attach that to alcoholism at all. I'm never thinking about the term alcoholism before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I spotted a few alcoholics. You could see them. They were somebody who's drunker than me earlier than me, you know, who acts inappropriate in an evening before it's appropriate to act inappropriate. But those lines all keep moving over time, right? But this painful abnormality that seemed like that's what felt different about me. I knew I had alcohol-related problems, right? I can identify these alcohol. You can connect the dots between me being drunk and me getting in some drunk trouble. But I didn't understand stone sober on a Tuesday afternoon with a good job, with a wife that loved me and a kid that loved me and a home where the mortgage was current and two cars that were paid for in the driveway. Why do I feel the way that I feel? And if you'd say, and I don't tell anybody that, you don't have that conversation because I don't know how to articulate how I feel. If I tell you, I know, you know, we hear it all the time, right? When people get to AA, and one of the most common refrains that we hear from people is say, I felt like I didn't fit in. Or the other one is, right, oh, I got here and without the instruction book, but I thought all you guys had the instruction book. Bill talks about it in the 12 and 12. He says, we're like actors in a play who've forgotten our lines. And I really, that resonates with me. I'm going through life like the actor in a play who doesn't know his lines. I don't have the script. And so I'm improvising all the time and trying to act like I know what I'm doing. And it's exhausting. That's an exhausting way for me to live, to keep trying to get whatever type of impression I think I need to get from you. And I had, you know, I couldn't connect that to my alcoholism until I get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you help me understand the breakdown of that first step, that my powerlessness over alcohol, this relationship I have to alcohol, but that my life had become unmanageable. Now for me, that unmanageability has nothing to do with the external circumstances of my life, that I got arrested, that I got DUIs, that Connie's mad at me, that I've got money trouble, all of those things. That's the chaos created by my drinking and by my alcoholism. But I view the unmanageability as an internal condition. I view the unmanageability as the spiritual malady of my illness. We talk about, and you'll often hear people debate, and I've given up. I've gotten out of the debating society, but I do have a point of view. And our book says that that's what each of us gets to do, is each of us in our own language and from our own point of view talks about how he established a relationship with God. And all a point of view is what it looks like from here. And from where I sit, based on my experience, we will hear people talk about alcoholism, and either it's a twofold disease, right? It's physical and mental. Or is it a threefold disease, spiritual, mental, and physical? And look, I'm not in charge of any of that stuff, but I'll tell you what it feels like to me. From my perspective, from my entry point, it feels like that my relationship with alcohol is physical and mental. That I don't seem to be able to stay stopped. And when I drink, I don't seem to be able to control the amount I take. But the unmanageability seems to be the spiritual component of my illness. And the 12 steps seem to treat the spiritual component, which negates the need for the physical aspect. And I'm better mentally. What does our book say? When I get better spiritually, I'll get better mentally and physically. And apparently, when I am moving toward a drink, those dominoes are falling in reverse. When I begin to falter spiritually, the old thinking will return, and I'll take a drink. Now, in my case, I've not had a drink since that June the 29th, but I have lapsed into some bad behavior. I've lapsed into some selfishness and self-centeredness. I've lapsed into being an extreme example of self-will run riot, though I usually don't think so. I will tell you, for me, I'm on Central Time at 5:15 today. I cursed the guy out and hung up on him. And then I thought, well, shit, I got to go get this AA talk. So that means I got to go call this guy and make an amends to him. So you guys have kept me back in the middle of the road. Now, here's the thing. I know my friends know this is true. I was right about my facts. The thing that I was frustrated and angry with this guy about, he's a guy that works for me. I was 100% right. But the third step tells me that a life run on self-will is gonna put me in collision with the world and its people, even when my motives are good, even when my facts are right. I spent time this morning. What a privilege I had this morning to speak to men and women in the Chicago Police Department, the men and women in recovery in the Chicago Police Department, who are out on the front lines of what's happening here. And they had sent an email telling me some of what they're having to endure. We know both sides of this thing have good people and bad people, and I get that. But I know what some of these people were dealing with themselves. And what a privilege that is. And then at 5:30, I'm, you know, telling the guy to F off. And then at 6 o'clock, I'm on here talking to you about a design for living that works in rough going. And all of that is true. I am everything that showed up today is all part and parcel of who I am. And I'm so grateful that when we read how it works, right? Right after we read it, and it says, but don't, you know, it might as well be talking to me. Don't panic, Steve. I know that's some pretty heavy stuff. Don't panic. You know, we're not saints. And none of us, not me, nor any of us, are going to come anywhere near perfect adherence to these principles. Well, what's the point of wasting our time with it then? Well, the point is, do I continue to be willing to grow along spiritual lines? And the answer is yes. The big picture answer is yes. But case by case, I will trip over myself. Case by case, that self-will will show back up, and I will be that extreme example of self-will run riot. So I get into that treatment center, and I didn't do that well on the test. But again, you guys helped me see right away that how I answer those is really not what makes me alcoholic or not. Those things are kind of indicators maybe, but I began to see what you shared with me about your alcoholism and I got the gift of identification that is the linchpin of Alcoholics Anonymous, one alcoholic sharing with another. That's what you guys have done for me for the last almost 31 years. You come on, and I show up here today that I'm going to tell you, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to be as honest as I can be, but I often kid I don't have the same commitment to accuracy because I'm sometimes honestly mistaken even about what happened to me. But we tell the truth. The thing of value that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is the truth about ourselves. And whether we tell it, whether it's me speaking to a group or whether it's us in our home group or whether it's over a cup of coffee, the real thing of value we have is our story. And I will tell you, I used to have a more exciting story than the one you're hearing tonight. I mean, it wasn't true, but it was really exciting. And what I discovered was it also wasn't useful. You know, if I start embellishing my story, if I make something up that didn't happen, or if I turn my back on something that did happen, I'm doing an equal disservice to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my story is not supposed to resonate with everyone. And your story will not resonate with everyone. That's why we all tell our stories. And we all tell the truth about ourselves so it can help that next person. We all cling to the thought that in God's hand, our darkest past becomes our greatest asset. We all know that those deepest failings that we had to get to Alcoholics Anonymous are the very tools by which we're going to be the most useful to the next man or woman that shows up. And to not bring those out and lay them in front of people would be a miscarriage and a lack of gratitude for the sobriety I've got and the transparency that men and women showed me when I showed up here. So that's what we do at our best. Suffice to say, I started going, went to treatment. Treatment was great. People from AA came in. We went out to a variety of 12-step meetings. I'm grateful for all of them. It allowed me to go to different 12-step meetings because I could have determined that I fit maybe in two or three different ones. But by going out, I knew that I most closely identified with Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I found the place where through identification with both the problem and the solution, I decided this is where I want to be. But I was nervous. If there are some new people on this call, you might be where I was. If you're on here, you probably at some level had decided you probably need to not drink. You may even have not had a drink for a little while. But man, I tell you what, I thought that I was going to spend a lot of time not drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought we'd just get together and actively not drink, you know. Would you look at him not drink over there, man, unbelievable. And did you see the technique on her? She looked like, oh, she reached for it, she pulled back. I thought life was going to be all about where I can't go and what I can't do and who I can't hang out with, right? My life's about to get really small. I'm going to do it. I mean, it's pitiful, but I'm going to do it because I need to not drink. I don't want to hurt the people. And isn't it amazing that even at that place, when I made the decision that I need to not drink, that was different than deciding I wanted to not drink. And it's amazing this relationship I had with alcohol, without telling all the stories, because we've all got them. But I mean, I had infidelities in my marriage. I wrecked, totaled those six automobiles. I had six DUIs. I was drunk at the hospital the day my daughter was born. I broke promises to the people I loved the most. I stole time and money from a family business. And then I put alcohol down and feel like it's a sacrifice. Like, but it's a sacrifice. And even our book says, right, even though you've convinced me I need to get out from under, but have you got a substitute? What are you going to give me? I'm putting down, you know, my relationship with alcohol, was an abusive relationship. It was a relationship just like a couple that are in an abusive relationship. And you know, every now and then I would break up with alcohol. It would beat the shit out of me, and I'd break up with it. And I said, we're done. And then maybe a week later, I'd get a late night alcohol booty call. I'd pick up and say, hey, Steve, man, can I come over? Let's just hang out. We'll just cuddle. And I'd say, okay. Me and alcohol would go on a couple of nice dates together. Then it'd beat the heck out of me again. And I kept thinking, like our book says, that I would somehow recapture the great moments of the past. Because when alcohol and I first started dating, we had a wonderful time together. We had some problems, but overall, man, we had a good time. But I've got this progressive illness in alcoholism. Bill had this progressive illness. He talks about it in his story. What a wonderful example in his story. He talks about early in his drinking when he and Lois, he's in school, and he says, one night I was too drunk to think or write. That's pretty drunk. He was too drunk to think or write. And he said it bothered Lois, but he was kind of cool with it. And then just a page over, it talks about the fact that alcohol had taken an important and exhilarating role in his life. And man, I remember when alcohol was important and exhilarating. And then it says that that he began to drink. He said he wasn't yet drinking every day and every night. And then he did something I guess no alcoholic should do. I've never been able to connect the dots here. But Bill said he took up golf, which permitted drinking every day and every night. Now, I've not yet found the correlation in golf that allows for drinking every day and every night, but apparently in Bill's case, it did. Then he said liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. And then he said gradually things got worse. And no one can describe the loneliness and horror of the next day. And that's where I end, but I've still tried to remember when alcohol was important and exhilarating. I got out of that treatment facility and I'm going to not drink. And I fell in with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I loved coming to AA meetings from the jump. I mean, it's really, you guys are fascinating people. I mean, I can just look at this screen. It's like the Jerry Springer Show every day in AA, man. It's just, it's an eclectic crowd. And I'd go and I'd listen to these fascinating stories, and sometimes I was comforted by how screwed up you were. And then I became comforted by hearing, because that's what all I heard at first. I heard about the problem. I heard you talking about what you did, and I heard you talking about how you felt. And boy, what a relief there was in that to find that, again, the identification, to find company, to realize, to hear someone else articulate that thing I had not been able to articulate. To hear you say something that was true about me, but I didn't know it. You would say it, and the moment you said it, I know that's true. The moment before you said it, I wouldn't have known. And finally, and I believe that what that is, my friends, in my opinion, that's the language of the heart. Because that's not a piece of intellectual information. That's something that resonates deep within. When I finally get that abnormal part of me you have articulated, you've described that thing which to me was indescribable. And how grateful I was for that. I heard almost everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous say they felt different. And I've come to the conclusion that if you feel different, that's the very thing that makes you like everyone else in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's another one of the paradoxes that we have. And what happens when we begin to share of ourselves honestly and fully and transparently, that thing that I've been hiding, that thing that I thought was different about me, actually becomes the spiritual connective tissue between me and you. The more I let you see me, the more connected we seem to be. And the more you allow me to see of you, the more connected I am to you. Yet I got pride and ego that tell me that won't work. My pride, the biggest thing, the impediment to me being close to you and close to God is my ego, is that self, that capital S-E-L-F. You know, the pride and ego show up dressed as your friends. They say they're here to protect you. No, you can't do that. No, you can't tell that. You can't let them know that. And boy, when I let you know it and you let me know it, that's when we find out we're not different, right? When the big book talks about after that fifth step, that sense of isolation will begin to evaporate. Because when I own it in front of you and you own it back with me, we frankly, that's where we connect. We connect in our defects much more than in our virtues. We connect in our human failings much more than pretending we don't have them. Pretending I don't have them is the hardest work I've done. I still fall into it. On any given day, what you think of me continues to be the most important thing. And the paradox again is the harder I try to make you think well of me, the more transparent that is to you. The most unattractive thing I do is try to impress you. I know because I keep trying. And I see it backfire all the time. See, I sobered up in Nashville, but I spent year two through almost eight in Richmond. And so I was there not too far from you guys. And my sponsor over there was a guy named Joe Sullivan, if any of you knew Joe. And Joe was a wonderful guy for me. And I called Joe one night, and I'd spoken at a meeting. I was about 4 years sober. I'd spoken almost as long as I've spoken here. And it was not a speaker meeting. And Joe was in the meeting, and I called him when I got home. And I was a little worried now. And I said, Joe, did I sound self-righteous in that meeting? And he said, oh, Steve, you're asking all the wrong questions. He says, because the question isn't, did you sound self-righteous? The question is, were you self-righteous? He said, but the truth is, you don't care whether you were self-righteous or not. You're afraid they think you're self-righteous. You're afraid they caught you. He says, you're not worried about the defect of character. You're worried what the defect looks like on you. And I will tell you, have you ever been walking down the street and trip on that phantom crack in the sidewalk and your arms flail and you make that terrible face? And what's the first thing I do? I look around to see who saw me. I'm not trying to keep from tripping. I'm trying to keep from getting caught tripping. And see, I think so pride and ego tells me how I look and what you think are the most important things. And so Joe shared with me that night. He said, Steve, here's the deal. He says, you are not who you think you are. And you are not who they think you are. And you are especially not who you think they think you are. And I will tell you that I have spent so much that, I mean, that's a wonderful piece of information because I got it that I spend all my time basing what I do on what I think you will think. And what that told me was I'm wrong about what you're going to think. I'm aiming at the wrong target when I'm spending my time trying to impress you. So Alcoholics Anonymous has turned me in a different direction. What happened when I got sober, when I began to get engaged in these steps, when I get to this third step, what you guys told me, is because I was resistant to any higher power or God talk. I often say that I went through my big book the first year I was sober here in Nashville, and I took a magic marker and blacked out everywhere it said the word God, everywhere it said the word spiritual experience, everywhere it said the word spiritual awakening. And when you talked about God, I would often spend time telling you what you were wrong about in your description or characterization of God. Sometimes I would do it to the group. Sometimes I would find you individually and help you. And ultimately, I wouldn't hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer at the end of meetings. I would back away from that. And I had a guy grab me one night and he said, Steve, help me understand that. Why are you stepping away from the circle? And I said, well, you know, I said, I don't know what I believe. I said, I don't think I believe in this God thing, so I don't want to be a hypocrite. And I'm not just going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya with the rest of the campers because that's what y'all are doing. And I felt kind of noble and self-righteous in that position. And he said, that's really impressive, man. He said, so let me get this right. He said, you cheated on your wife, you wrecked your cars, You drunk when your daughter was born. You stole time and money. But hypocrisy, that's where you draw the line, huh? He says, that's where you're going to plant your flag, and with hypocrisy. He said, I got good news for you and bad news for you. And you know, I felt a little condescended too. And if you're newer here to AA and you have ever felt condescended to, it's because somebody was just being condescending to you. And that's what was happening that day. But he says, I got good news for you and bad news for you. And I said, I'll play, you know. What's the bad news? He said, the bad news is hypocrisy is way down your list of problems. And you might ought to address them in the order in which they will kill your ass. And I said, well, what's the good news? And he said, the good news is there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, I'm as grateful for that tonight as I was 30 years ago, you know, because some days I'm going to sound like a hypocrite. And some days I'm going to look like a hypocrite. And some days I'm going to be hypocritical. It won't be on purpose. It will just be a human failing. Because we get on here and the spouse already told you that, man, I wish you could have heard me talking to those Chicago police. It have brought a tear to your eye. And then I'm flipping that guy off this afternoon. I'm verbally, and I'm just, you know, which one of those guys am I? I am both. Neither one of those is a fake guy. I'm capable of both of those things at any given time. And I'm just trying to keep the meter over here on the good side as much as possible. And but I finally decided to, so I began to just hold hands and say the prayer. If nothing else, it made me feel like part of the group. I get to that third step, and this is where the game changes for me. And I think it's where it changes for all of us I don't always see it when it's happening. But the third step is where you guys, in the second step, you know, the first step I'm saying I'm powerless, but I don't know if I believe it. I mean, I'm saying it, and actually I do mean it, but I'm not sure of the depth of that powerlessness. I'm not sure what that means. I know I have trouble staying sober, but powerless. And then that second step, I concede, I come to the conclusion that I'm going to need a power other than me to solve my problem. And the third step, I'm making a decision to seek that power other than mine to solve that problem. Up until then, I've been spending a lot of time trying to solve my problem. I've been trying to not drink. Or I've been trying to not drink too much. Or I've been trying to not let that happen again. I've been trying hard to do better. And I've been telling people, I mean it. I'm going to do better. And I did. I did mean it. But I don't understand. I can't do better by force of will and good intentions. I can't do better by coming at my problem. And Alcoholics Anonymous, at the third step, you redirect me. You turn me away from my problem. You tell me, in not so many words, to quit worrying about your problem. You tell me to embrace the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous offers. You tell me that my job now is to remove those things that block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. You tell me the process of these steps are going to connect me to a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. So when we get back to the 10th step in the big book, it suggests that if I'm current with the actions laid out there, with those simple actions, that I will have this whole new attitude toward liquor. It says I'll be in this position of neutrality, that I won't be fighting it, and that I won't be cocky or afraid. And it says this new attitude has been given me with no thought or effort on my part. And I thought, are you kidding me? I've been busting my ass here in AA. I've been working steps. I've been taking commitments. Hell, I gave that guy a ride last week. I've been doing some really inconvenient stuff here in AA. What do you mean I'm not no thought or effort on my part? But what I realize now is that the thought or effort on my part isn't about a new attitude toward liquor. The thought and effort on my part is about connecting to this power greater than myself. The thought and effort in AA is about establishing a relationship with God. And when I am connected to that power, it solves my problem. That attitude came in, and every other aspect of my life is impacted by my relationship to that power. My relationship to you is impacted by my relationship to God. In fact, I don't think I can have a relationship with you if I don't have one with God, and I don't think I can have one with God if I don't have it with you. When our book says that the 12 and 12 says that one, that the total inability of a guy like me to form a true partnership with another human being, the reason forever I could not form a true partnership is I never brought authentically who I am to the partnership. I never gave you a chance to partner with who I really am until I navigated through these steps and peeled away that bondage of self and landed here at a spot where all of a sudden now my relationships are real. Where I felt disconnected, I feel connected. That sense of loneliness, which is what absolutely was the benchmark of my unmanageability. I had a lot of people in my life. I was a pretty popular guy. I looked confident. I looked outgoing, but I was lonely. I talked earlier about steeling myself up to go through that door and go into those situations, work, social, and professional. And then I would leave those places and that door would close behind me and I would be empty. I would be empty. There was a loneliness that's the core of my alcoholism. And our book says the alcoholic knows loneliness as few do. And what I will tell you today, that is not nearly as prevalent as it had been previously. That as I go through these steps, as I connect to this power greater than myself, and maybe someone will ask me a question about that because I'm about out of time, because this conception of this power has been an evolving process for me, as I hope it will continue to be. I hope if I come on here a year from now and visit with you that there'll be some growing evolution in my relationship with this power. Not something that will mean what I believe tonight was wrong, but I am able to believe more, to see more, to feel more. And that isn't that at the core of the spiritual experience that our book talks about, that I'll be able to do, feel, and believe that which I could not do, feel, and believe on my unaided will or resources alone. I'm going to end this talk like I end every talk I give because I made a promise to myself over 17 years ago. There's a man here in Nashville, and you guys have him. This was the guy when I was going to meetings. My sponsor certainly played this role, but a guy named Mo. Mo Holland was an iconic AA figure here locally in Nashville. And he did some speaking I didn't know till after he had died. But Mo was that guy, you know, when you go to your meeting and you're sitting there and that man or woman comes in the door and you're so glad they're there. And when you're newly sober, that man or woman comes in and you just know everything's going to be okay. You don't know why you know it. You don't know what it is, but I just know I feel better because you're here. And Mo was that guy for me. And man, I try to get over where I could sit next to him in the meeting, you know. And Mo always recited the voice to verse to a poem when he ended his talks. And when he came down with cancer in 2003 and just weeks before he passed away, my friend Jerry and I took him to breakfast and we knew our time was short with him. And I said, Mo, would you mind if when I get a chance to share my story, I end with that poem that you have told all these years because it has meant so much to me. And it speaks to my relationship with God. And most importantly, it allowed me to pass on what you've given to me and so many others. And Mo just said, he said, "Aw, Steve," he was a little embarrassed, you know, and he went, "Aw, Steve," he said, "if you think it'll help another drunk." And I will tell you, every time I've shared my story for the last 17 years, I've ended with this. And I've been fortunate to share it with literally tens of thousands of people. And I will tell you, it's helped another drunk every single time. Because I'm the drunk, it helps. And he said, I sought my God, I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. But I sought my fellow man and found all three. And see, that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I can't get my arms around this big God thing that's bigger than me, I don't debate what it is, how it is, any of that stuff. I just know that when you invite me here to share myself with you as I've tried to do tonight, and when you guys participate by pretending to pay attention like you are tonight, then what happens is this power shows up in a way that I can't define or comprehend. But it's made it unnecessary for me to take a drink since June the 29th of 1989. And for the vast majority of that time, when I'm willing and surrendered, it has offered me a life that is happily and usefully whole. And for that, I'm entirely and unendingly grateful. Thank you so much for having me here tonight.
Oh, thank you. I'm gonna allow everyone to unmute for a moment. Thank you so much, man. Steve, that was wonderful.
Yeah, thank you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Fire! Woo!
Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right. All right, we're going to give Steve a break for a second. Let's see. I'm going to post the PayPal link one more time. Seventh Tradition states that AA, every AA group ought to be self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seventh Tradition is essential. At every level of AA service, it is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. And just by way of reminder, please text your questions to the user questions in the participants tab. When we reconvene in a few minutes, we'll start going through those questions. We've got quite a few, but keep them coming. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I will be happy to take a few announcements for the good of AA. If you raise your little blue hand, I will unmute you. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, you can send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right, last call on announcements. All righty then. All right, Steve, that was absolutely amazing. We've got a question from a member here. How do you get closer to your higher power?
Well, there are multiple ways, but in terms of, if I wrap that around the 11th step a little bit, I will tell you that every morning, I'm much better in the mornings than I am the evenings, but when I was sponsoring guys, I would get a new guy, started about 5 years ago, and I would ask them to go through that 11th step exercise. I'd ask them to give me a couple of things in the morning they were grateful for, to give me a couple of things that maybe they had hanging over their head or felt some fear or trepidation about in this 24 hours, if there was anything. I'd ask them to give me their plans for the day, two or three things like our book suggests. And a guy got real excited, you know, as a young guy. And he said, man, that's great. He said, so you do that? And I said, well, I do now. And so for the last 3 years, probably 90%+ of the time, and I miss some, I do that. And I also do some reading every morning in a book that I will pick and read a few passages and journal about what I have, what my takeaway from that. The other thing is, I mean, the way to get closer to God, as I said at the end of the talk, is to get closer to you. And so everything we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is about getting closer to God. In fact, you know, that's every step. There's not a spiritual part of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can tell. Every step is a spiritual step. Every action every simple action that you guys have identified is a spiritual action. And all of those, the persistent, a faulty attempt to navigate through that continues to build this relationship. The conscious awareness of that relationship. I talked to a guy yesterday, or he was on a little meeting that we were on, some guys I sponsor, and he says, I've just got to get more spiritual. And I said, you know what? I really don't think you have to get more spiritual. I just think that, like all of us, you want to access the spirituality that's already there. We're not trying to get something. We're trying to get rid of those things that block me off. And that's what everything in AA is designed to do. But I do spend quiet time. I do spend prayer time. I do intermittent meditation. And some guided meditations as well that I'll listen to when my head's spinning. So a variety of different practices.
Thank you. Yeah, there actually is a question. What does your 11 step look like today? But I think we got a 2-for-1 out of that. What do you do if a sponsee stops calling you?
Nothing. There's not much to do right now. I will say that if it is someone, if it's a new guy, or actually anybody that I sponsor, if all of a sudden I don't hear from that person, if it's irregular, you know, I've been hearing from him and now I'm not, I'll reach out and say, what's going on? I'll give a call. I have relationships with some of these guys for, 18, 20 years. So some men I've sponsored that long. Other guys are newer. But what I don't do, And I don't get frustrated by that anymore. I used to. And I don't know whether what I do is a right thing or a wrong thing, but I believe what any of us brings to sponsorship is sort of like I was saying in the talk, because I just try to bring who I am to it. And that might look different on different people. In each relationship, early in my sobriety, I spent a lot of time giving thought to my sponsorship style. Am I going to be, because I'd hear people talk about it, right? You heard them talk about, oh man, my sponsor, he loved me. Till I could love myself. He patted me on the back. He encouraged me to go to meetings and let you know what I was thinking. And then the next guy's in the room says, my sponsor told me to sit down and shut up. I didn't know a damn thing about staying sober and I couldn't speak for 6 months. Apparently, both of those work at some level with different people and everything in between. So I try to have a relationship with the person that I'm sponsoring, and it might be different with this person than the next person. But I'll reach out. I try to encourage, but not coerce. So if somebody's disappearing, I'm gonna try to make it easy to come back for a few times. And then if I don't hear from that person, I'll stop, and then I'll wait. And I might wait 2 or 3 months and throw a text out and say, man, I hadn't seen you, heard from you. Hope everything's okay. If I can be helpful, let me know. But I don't finger wag and I don't shame. I treat sponsorship, I treat them being a sponsor and me being their sponsor as a volunteer situation. I assume you're interested when you ask me to be your sponsor. So I don't spend much time trying to talk people into anything.
All right. And I think I definitely heard you say there's not you don't have a one size fits all sort of approach to sponsorship.
I think if you got the men I sponsor in a room and asked them to describe me, it would sound different man to man. I hope there would be some common themes, but depending on our book says that our only aim is to be helpful. So with each person, I'm saying, what's going to be helpful to this guy? And, It And that can be a little different case to case, or my assessment. And I try to always invite God into that assessment.
Beautiful. Could you, would you like to share a little bit about what it being a home group member means to you? What has a home group done for you? What does it mean to be a member, et cetera? Anything about a home group that you'd like to talk about?
Well, it's been really impactful to me and helpful to me. And I've gone through, you heard me say that my home group is the Recovery on the Road group. And that's been my home group now for almost 4 years. For the 18 years prior to that, my home group was a group called the Backroom Group that's here in Nashville. And man, that home group was great. It's a great meeting and it's a great group. And they're a three legacy group. And everything about that group I love. And I attended the meeting this morning on Zoom. But I began traveling. The Backroom Group meets on Saturday and Sunday mornings at both 9 and 10 a.m. And I was traveling over half the weekends a year that I was gone from that group. And it took me, what I realized was the group was serving me very well, but I wasn't serving the group very well. I couldn't take a commitment. I wasn't there for the business meetings. I wasn't engaged at that level with the group. I attended and I loved it, but I wasn't a three legacy member of a three legacy group. So a friend of mine and I started the Recovery on the Road group, which is and Backroom Group's a big group. It'll have about 140 people on Saturday and Sunday mornings, and I just love it. Recovery on the Road is a little group, and we typically have 27 seats is all we've got in the main room, and then you have to move off to a little side room. And I told them at our first anniversary after we started the meeting, I said, there's not a person in this group that I would have invited to this meeting the first day we had it. And what I mean by that is, and the best thing about it is that group didn't look anything like I envisioned it looking like when we opened the door and made the first pot of coffee. And I met a whole group of people that I had not met before and wasn't spending time with before, and a lot of new people. It's housed in a treatment facility in an outpatient building, certainly not affiliated, but in that space. And so some people would end up coming there. And that's been great. So I go every Wednesday, and when I'm in town, I get to go down there and I get to make the coffee and I get to be a part of setting up and I get to sit and be there that 30 minutes early and talk to people. And that has really reconnected me at the group level in a way that I was feeling disconnected. So that's been critical.
All right. I have a question here. If you were writing a daily reflection, what piece of AA literature would you choose and what would you say?
Oh man, that's deep. That's one of those let me get back to you questions, man. But and the only reason is because you're always afraid that the answer I give will be so shallow. And if you give me some time, I can make something up that would be really impressive. I love both the Big Book and the 12 and 12 I find the 12 and 12, I'm a Big Book guy, and that's where those simple actions are outlined. But the 12 and 12 helps deepen and broaden my understanding of those steps, and I love the writing style in there. I think that I would probably focus on, it talks about the fact that we never thought of making kindness and courtesy and true love of man and God the basis for daily living. And I look at that a lot and think about what if that's the baseline for my day? What if I walk out the door and that's my baseline? Love God, love my fellow man, be kind, be courteous, be considerate, be thoughtful, be compassionate. I would probably try to build something around that and tell you what Bill meant to say.
Right on. What does frothy emotional appeal mean to you?
Well, frothy emotional appeal was when my mother would beg me not to do that again. Frothy emotional appeal is when my brother, who I worked for, now there's frothy when someone's begging you, and there's frothy when someone's worked up into anger, and that froth, and both of those are frothy and emotional. And I got both of those, and I deserved them both, and neither of them were effective. That frothy emotional appeal is when somebody is coming from a deep, deep spot, and often out of love, and are begging somebody they care about to please. Please don't do that to yourself. Please don't do that to us. And it is ineffective. And we can also, we talk about it on the recovery side as well, because in working with others, it says that we don't speak down to anyone, and we don't talk to anyone from a spiritual mountaintop, you know? And I've got to be careful not to fall into frothy emotional appeal around recovery. But if I'm going to make a mistake, I'd love it to be the latter rather than the former.
Right. Have you got maybe one or two amends stories?
I got two. I'll tell two. I've got more. But but one of them was just about 2 years ago, well into recovery. And so one amends story I'll tell you that is when I got sober, and you guys heard me say that there'd been some infidelities in my marriage. And by the way, those were mine, not hers. And I think they were undetected. And I got sober and I did my inventory. And those things were on there. That behavior was on there. And I got with my sponsor. And as we navigated through that, and with prayer and his guidance, different people might arrive at a different conclusion. But through that, we determined that was information that would do more harm than good to her, not to me. We never make the decision to protect ourselves, but to protect others. But we landed that it wasn't the right time. But we did the 8-step work. And that's what was important. Before deciding not to make the amend, we go through the 8-step and became willing to make it. And looked at what that would look like and sound like if I did make it. And what I would do and what I wouldn't do. What should be said and what should not be said in that type of amend. Our book talks about it. And then we shelved it as an amend that should not be made. Certainly at this time. 4 years later, Connie and I are having a conversation one day. It wasn't an argument. It was a good conversation. And then somewhere in there, she just looked at me and asked a question she had never asked before. And she said, "Have you ever been unfaithful in our marriage?" And I knew that I was not going to be able to lie. I knew I wasn't going to be able to pull it off, even if I tried. And I intuitively knew that it was now time to deal with this and make this amend. And I did, and I'm so grateful that we had done the work, that it wasn't that I had been willing. The freedom comes in the willingness. And I had been willing, and I knew, as best you can navigate that tough territory, what to say, how to say it, and what not to say. And I give her so much credit and her spiritual grace for oh, she was hurt. She was crushed. But not pressing for that, all the stuff I would want to know, who, when, where, you know, somebody we know, all of that stuff. And we navigated through that. And I want to say before I forget, because I didn't tell you guys earlier, when Connie told me not to not to stop drinking no matter what, her sobriety date's 10 days after mine. And so we've been a sober husband and wife for over 30 years together, and she's an active AA member, and I aspire to be the AA member that she is. But flash forward a number of years, I was at a men's retreat, and I'm talking to these, I'm leading the retreat, and I'm talking to these guys all weekend. This was just 2-3 years ago. And somehow, as we were talking about, and I think we're in the 10th step, but anyway, the conversation came up about how often I had, over the years, made Connie feel like And she would say, you know, you tried to make me feel crazy. I would say you did something. And by the time I was done defending myself and challenging her, she began to question herself. And I often chipped away at her self-confidence. When we went out somewhere, I would make her the butt of my jokes. And it was never about her. It was my own insecurity. But a whole host of things. And I'm sharing it with these guys. And as I'm sharing it, I realized I had never made amends for that. I knew it was true, but somehow I'd never talked to her about it. And I will tell you, I came home on that Sunday afternoon and sat down and I said, I need to tell you something. I need to own something. And we walked through it, and it doesn't seem like a big deal, but it was, I think, for her and for me, the most potent amends that I have made in terms of cementing our relationship even deeper than it was, and a recognition that I had done that, and I knew I had done that, and I'm sorry I did that, and I won't do that anymore. So that's two.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. How does your relationship with God grow after 30 years?
Well, I think that it is stronger now. And again, I don't know if stronger, perhaps, as you said, it is deeper. I think maybe that's the term. It is deeper in my conscious awareness of God's presence in my life is stronger than it's ever been. But let me tell you what that looks like on me, because I think it's I told you all that resistance I had to God. And the wonderful thing that AA has given me, and I think all of us, is that broad and roomy highway, and that God does not make too tough terms on those who seek him. And that we get to have that conception of God. And I used to hear that when my first few years sober. I mean, I heard intellectually that I get to have my own conception of God, but I didn't really believe it. I really believed what you were telling me is if I stick around long enough that I'll come around to your way of thinking, whatever that is, like I knew what your way of thinking was. And here's what it feels like for me today. Have I had a spiritual experience? I believe I have. And here's how I know. That because I believe a spiritual experience is almost for me as simple and as profound as experiencing life spiritually. I view my higher power as connecting to this power. And I don't think of the power, and I don't think of God as doing anything to me or for me. I'm trying to connect to the power, and the power does whatever it does. I walked out today in the sun. The sun didn't decide who to shine on. I had to get in the sun. I didn't have to undiscern the sun's approval. I didn't have to sit in purgatory for 6 months waiting on the sun to shine on me. The sun was ready the moment I was to get in. I had a friend of mine years ago, still a friend of mine, Mike Allison. Mike speaks a lot, and some of you guys might have heard Mike. And he used to be in the sod business, and he came over to our house years ago and laid some sod in our backyard because I had visions of building this little courtyard. We built a fence, spent a lot of money on this fence, and all of this stuff. And he laid this beautiful grass down in about a 30 by 20 space. And about 3 weeks later, that very green, lush, and expensive grass had turned into dirt. And I called Mike back over and I said, man, this is, you got to help me out here. And he surveyed the area. And we were encircled by trees. That's why I wanted to do this little courtyard. And he said, Steve, the problem is the sun can't get through. This grass can't grow because the sun can't shine on it. And if you want this grass to grow, you're going to have to trim back those trees. And I would tell you the way I grow in my relationship with God is to trim back the spiritual trees so the light can come through. And when it does, it changes my experience of life. So years ago, my wife and daughter took me to the movie Avatar. You guys remember, some of you, when that movie came out. And when it came out, it was the reintroduction of 3D glasses. Those things, last time I'd had on 3D glasses, they were cardboard. And these glasses, man, you know, there's a 3D movie out now, you know, seven of them every week somewhere. But this was pretty big deal. And we go to the IMAX theater, and I became fascinated by this 3D technology. And I'm watching this movie, you know, and then I would take the glasses off. And I'd watch the movie with the glasses off. And then I put the glasses back on. And, you know, when I took the glasses off, it's the same movie. And it's the same actors. And it's the same dialogue. And it's the same story. But it's two-dimensional. It's just height and width, but no depth. And when I put the glasses on, it was clearer. And it was a richer experience. And it added a depth and a third dimension that wasn't there that I couldn't see. It was there. I could not see it without the glasses. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you've introduced me to a fourth dimension in a three-dimensional world. When I am connected to that power, that fourth dimension comes on. I think that's the new pair of glasses that Chamberlain was talking about, that I see the world differently. I don't see what wasn't there. I see what was there all along, but I could not see. I have a different experience in the world and with you than I had without those glasses. That's how that relationship grows with that power. It grows as I begin to experience and have an awareness of that God consciousness around me.
All right. Let's see. Joe Sullivan was a Virginia area delegate to the General Service Conference. Have you been involved in service, and what or what's your experience with service work?
Well, Joe put me in service right away. The very first meeting we went to together after I asked him to be my sponsor, at the end of the meeting, they said that their intergroup rep had left, and Joe said, Steve will do it. And I became, there was no vote, there was no nothing. They said, Steve will do it. Then I became on the cooperation with the professionals community. I became the corrections chair. Then at 6 years sober, Joe called me and he said, I want you to go to the district meeting this week. He said, they're going to have nominations for a DCM. And I said, I don't want to be a DCM. And I said, number one, that's a 2-year commitment and I'm not a 2-year guy. And, I'm a hit and run service guy. I'm, you know, if there's a big enough crowd, I'll let you catch me doing something good. But I don't want a commitment. I don't want something on the calendar every month. And Joe said, I know. He said, that's why. He said, Steve, I just asked you to go to the meeting. He said, what makes you think? I'm not asking you to be DCM. But I knew the fix was in, at least in terms of the nomination. But I go and I'm nominated. And they nominated two other people. Some of y'all might know that nominated Jack C. And Ross. So me, Ross, and Jack, and they start the election, and I'm third and getting thirder with each time, but they don't get a quorum. But finally they go to the hat, and I know when they go to the hat that I'm about to be the DCM. There's no way around it. And they pull my name out of that hat, and I went home and told my wife, this is my worst nightmare. I said, I lost the popularity contest and have to do the work. And I was the most inept DCM in the history of District 29, south of the James. But I will tell you, and I've told people this for all the years since then, that I often hear people speak about service, and they will say in kind of a snide voice, it'll teach you patience and tolerance. The implication being to hold that position will require patience and tolerance to deal with the other people. But I would share with you that the men and women of District 29 extended unbelievable patience and tolerance toward me, allowing me to learn and grow into a position that I really felt ill-equipped for. So I'm grateful for that. I do have to say one more thing Joe told me about that. And some of you guys in service know, you got some professional GSRs, right? They'll come to the district meeting. Man, they'll call the question. They'll Robert Rules of Order. They'll start bringing the heat. And I was overwhelmed by that. And I told Joe, I said, I don't know what to do when all that starts. And he said, Steve, next time that happens, he said, just stop them and evoke concept six. And I said, I don't have any idea what concept six is. He said, they won't either. So just go ahead and do it.
Oh, that's brilliant. Oh man. I'm trying to think. We're out on time. But I guess I'll leave you with your comments on the 12th step, working with others.
Well, you know, Don Pritch used to say that's the work. We work the steps so we can then work with others. That's the whole game. And that's what the 12 steps says, and what I hope I've done it in some measure here tonight. The 12 step has a declaration and two calls to action. The 12 step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. So what's the message that I have to carry? The only message I have to carry is that I've had a spiritual experience and it was a result of these steps. And what we do is share that experience with each other. I share my experience with the book, with the steps, the actions I took when I took those simple actions and put them into play in my life. And then practicing these principles in all my affairs is where you told me this is where it turns. And now I begin to live my life based on these principles rather than on my feelings and my thinking. That when I'm trying to figure out what to do next, fear should not be guiding my actions. It doesn't mean I'm through being afraid. It means I try not to let fear dictate what I do. I try not to let greed dictate what I do. I try to follow this spiritual true north, which is what these 12 steps, these principles that we're, and what are the principles? You know, we all of us have got somewhere. I know this is a committed group. So you guys somewhere got a note where you've got the 12 steps and you got 12 principles out, you know, principle out next to each step. And I've got a dozen of those and each one of them are different. And I think you can take any principle and stick it next to any step. And if it's spiritual, it's going to fit. But I think that when it says I'm going to practice these principles in all my affairs, it means I'm going to apply these first 11 steps into how I live my life. The 12 steps are themselves the spiritual principles that are being referred to. And I'm now making those the active, that they are active. It is now, as the 11 steps said, a working part of the mind. That's where the numbers fall off the steps and I begin to go live this. I went to my sponsor at 6 months sober. They're in Nashville still, and this guy named Frank. And I said, Frank, man, I think practicing these principles in all my affairs is putting me at a competitive disadvantage in the marketplace. I'm not sure everybody got the memo on this. And he said, Steve, only seemingly so. He said, if you're asking me if you're not going to get a deal, a particular deal, because you won't turn a blind eye or shave a corner or entertain in a particular way, he said, absolutely. Anecdotally, you're going to lose opportunities. He said, but you have no idea the number of people who have quietly chosen not to do business with you. He said, probably not even because of your drinking. You're just not their kind of guy. And he says, what you're giving off. And he says, if you will practice these principles, if you will adopt this way of life, he said, I'm not promising you that you'll be president of a Fortune 500 company. But the people who are supposed to be drawn to you will be drawn to you. And you will sleep a full 8 hours at night. And when you shave in the morning, you can look the man in the eye in the mirror. And that has been true with momentary lapses. But I know that information is true. And that's what practicing these principles does. I'll end that with this and then give it back to you and be done. Cliff Roach, because some of the folks on here may have used to hear Cliff died a few years ago. He's a great AA member out in Southern California, out in Oceanside. And at 37 years sober, he led a men's retreat that I was a part of. And he said, in my 37 years sober, he said, I've learned three things that are absolutely true. And he said, the first one is surrender never looks like a good idea coming upon. The second is never has surrender not served me well in the long run. Third, I can never remember number two the next time. And I think that remains true, that I know that practicing these principles in all my affairs is in my best interest. But case by case, I get a little skittish sometimes. Again, thanks for having me here, man. It's been fun, David, and thank all of you for your questions.
Thank you, Steve. We're going to open it up for thanking Steve in just a minute here. Thank you, everybody who participated. And I think BJ is going to read the last two paragraphs on page 164, please.
My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
BJ?
A Vision for You, Big Book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, BJ. I'm going to, as you may unmute as you see fit for a moment of silence and followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom, and the power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thank you, Steve. That's amazing.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Awesome. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. I miss hearing about Chuck E. Cheese, though, Steve.
Well, I'll tell it another time.